Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This past weekend, in 8 cities, at least 65 people were shot, 17 fatally. The most horrific shooting happened on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. A white 18-year-old traveled 3.5 hours to East Buffalo to target a black neighborhood. The 18-year-old shooter legally bought a semi-automatic rifle in New York and illegally modified it using a high-capacity magazine, according to officials. We discussed what we can do to stop racist shootings on yesterday's show, which you can find at yourcallradio.org. On Friday night, 21 people were shot in 3 separate incidents in downtown Milwaukee, where a crowd of 11,000 gathered outside to cheer on the Milwaukee Bucks. That same night, gunfire erupted in an entertainment district in Dallas. 5 people were shot, 2 were killed. On Sunday, 1 person was killed and 5 were wounded in a shooting at a Taiwanese church in Laguna Woods, California. The 68-year-old shooter, a U.S. citizen who grew up in Taiwan, was motivated by political hatred toward Taiwan that was documented in handwritten notes, according to officials. He legally purchased 2 9mm handguns in Las Vegas. According to the AP, a doctor, Dr. John Chang, tackled him, allowing other parishioners to subdue him and tie him up with extension cords. The New York Times reports that yesterday, a 36-year-old man who police said had expressed anti-Asian sentiment was arrested in connection with a shooting last week at an Asian-run hair salon in Dallas that left 3 women wounded. This just happened in the last week, and I could probably have added so many more to this list. There have been 201 mass shootings this year in which 4 or more people were injured or killed, according to the Gun Violence Archive. The majority of the population in so many polls support some kind of common sense gun control. But without 60 votes in the Senate or getting rid of the filibuster, gun control legislation will not move because of Republican gridlock. Here is Democratic Senator Dick Durbin on NBC.
It pains me to say it, but in the great city of Chicago, I'm honored to represent. Hardly a day goes by that someone isn't shot, and on the weekends, there's a shooting spree with 20, 30 people shot, 7 or 8 dead when it's over. This has become commonplace, not just Chicago, but certainly in that great city as well. And you say to yourself, well, Durbin, you're the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. You're from Illinois. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do about it? Well, you know the math. This is a 50-50 Senate, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. It takes 60 votes to do anything significant or controversial. We don't have 60 votes for any kind of gun safety legislation, even legislation accepted by the vast majority of people, whether it's background checks to keep guns out of the hands of convicted felons and people who are mentally unstable, whether it's getting rid of ghost guns, these guns that are being sold without any identification or serial number. The list goes on of common sense things we can do to make America safer. We cannot get virtually any Republican support for it.
That is Democratic Senator Dick Durbin speaking on NBC. In Republican-dominated states, lawmakers are expanding access to guns. According to the New York Times, since the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in 2012, 14 Republican-controlled states have passed laws allowing citizens to carry guns with no permit process, while 13 states, all controlled by Democrats, have enacted or expanded background checks for new gun purchases. So given this, what do we do? Joining us are 2 guests. Timothy Litton is Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. Professor Litton is author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Hi, Professor Litton. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Abarno is a trial lawyer who has been practicing law for almost 30 years. Kenneth Abarno is representing the family of Ruth Whitfield, an 86-year-old who was shot and killed by a self-described white supremacist on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Kenneth. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Kenneth, you attended a heartbreaking press conference with Ruth Whitfield's family, and I was watching it in real time. Just to remind people or those who don't know about Ruth, she was the primary caretaker of her husband. She was returning from a visit with him at a nursing home when she was shot and killed at the Tops grocery store. And Ken, at the press conference, you said you have been practicing law for almost 30 years, and you never thought you'd be back in your hometown talking about such a horrible event. And you call this a senseless, preventable act of destruction and violence. Can you elaborate on that? You said preventable is the key word there.
Sure. And thank you again. And the Whitfield family were honored, along with Harry Connors and the Ben Crump Law Firm, to be representing such a tremendous family after such a tragedy. And what we have been able to identify, at least in the short time since this tragedy occurred, is that there are circumstances that were going on with this person's background that should have been found out. People should have been alerted to and should have found out these facts going on with this young man. And had the right work been done, this gun would not have made it into his hands, and he would not have had the opportunity to destroy so many lives. So we believe it's preventable because of red flags that exist that we know of now, and additional information that we're learning on a hourly, if not minute-by-minute basis.
Can you tell us more about that? Because we've done shows about, you know, how do you deal with young people like this man? NPR reports that the gun purchase took place months after New York State police briefly took him into custody after he made a threat about a shooting. State police investigated him and ordered a psychiatric evaluation. After a day and a half in a hospital, he was released. He did not remain on law enforcement's radar. So tell us more about what should have happened. How should this have been dealt with?
Well, first, out of respect for the family and the investigation, there's certain things that we can talk about, certain things that we are not able to, at least in a position to talk about. But you highlighted some red flags right there that talk about the notice that people had with respect to problems that this young man had in his background. The reasons that he was placed under psychiatric evaluation, and data or information that we are being told was accessible and or available. And had that information been utilized by the right sources, we wouldn't be here today. And it's a building block. You have brick by brick by brick when you put the pieces together. Once we have the rest of those pieces together, we'll see how there should have been a wall put up, and he should not have had this gun in his hands.
Professor Linton, can you also comment on this? Because a lot of kids make threats in schools. A lot of kids are sent to the counseling office. The parents might be called. How should this be dealt with?
One of the things that we know about a lot of these mass shooting events, especially that involve young people, is that there are often signs, as there was in this case, of mental illness and trouble and extremism. And I think the schools have spent a lot of time, and there's been a lot of public policy organizing around lockdown drills and sort of treating this as if it were an emergency sort of fire type arrangement. And it seems to me that this tragedy, as well as many others, illustrates that no amount of prevention in terms of what you're supposed to do when people start shooting is likely to stop these events. I think what we need is much greater detection. This has been the approach in large measure to things like terrorism, where you see something, you say something. The best protection to a bombing on the subway is the vigilance of the rioters. And I think that there were signals here that this young man had extremist views and that he suffered from some sort of mental illness, and that red flag laws, state red flag laws, are designed precisely to be an address where that information can go so that the authorities can do something. And it looks like in this case that they didn't take these warnings seriously enough. Perhaps it's also the case that school authorities probably should have been monitoring the situation beyond, at least it appears, beyond what has been reported that they did, which was to report him to the police. There was a sort of one-time checkup on him, and then nobody seemed to pay much attention after that. And I think that sort of lack of vigilance is probably the key place to apply some sort of reform or pressure if we want to get some sort of change, because there are people who spotted issues here. And if there had been better follow-up, we might have been able to avoid this tragedy. And that's probably true in many other similar situations as well.
Given that Americans own 393 million firearms, which is half of the world's civilian firearms, and it is so easy to buy a gun, do you think, and how would this work out, that this young man's name should have been in the background check database, because Robert Donald, the owner of Vintage Firearms in Endicott, New York, told NPR that the firearm was purchased this year. He confirmed that he had run a background check on the 18-year-old, but the report showed nothing. Professor Litton?
Well, we're talking about two slightly different mechanisms here. One is the red flag law, in which individuals or authorities like the police can basically block, get a restraining order from a judge that blocks a person's ability to purchase a firearm outside of the background check system. And that seems to be the mechanism that should have been in play here. As far as the background check system is concerned, there are certain triggers that would register a person in the background system as ineligible to purchase a firearm. And one of those would be some sort of record of mental illness or a violation of the law. We don't necessarily have those things here. And I think the red flag law is in some ways designed to be a little bit more fine-tuned, where a person doesn't have to have an official record or official incident in order to be a person of concern. And the background check system is sort of a permanent bar to a person's purchasing of a weapon, whereas the red flag law is a kind of more in real time monitoring of a person's suitability to possess firearms, not just purchase them, but to even have them in the home. It seems to me that the red flag law is probably the better instrument suited to deal with the kind of incident that we saw here in Buffalo recently.
So how would that play out on the ground? If this 18-year-old legally could not buy a gun because of a red flag law, how would the owner of that gun shop know that?
I don't know the details actually of the New York law, but if there's an order out preventing a person from purchasing a firearm, then that would show up in a background check, but it wouldn't be necessarily something that would be reported directly to the FBI, I don't think. But as I said, I don't know the details of the New York red flag on how it works, but certainly when a background check was run, it would have prevented the person from purchasing a firearm. There's always a question that people raise about substitution, whether or not someone who's barred from purchasing a firearm at a retail outlet or a gun store could have obtained one otherwise, because as you mentioned, there are a lot of guns floating around in private hands. But I do think that certainly we would want to take whatever measures would make marginal improvements in people's access to firearms who are subject to these sorts of attacks, and certainly preventing them from purchasing them at retail would be a place to think about.
Right. But that's just where we are right now. Kenneth, what would you add? How should the red flag laws play out in practice? If someone is flagged, what happens when they go to a gun store?
Well, as Timothy pointed out, you're going to have to look at these specific red flag laws that go into effect and that are in effect, in particular in New York. And it's not necessarily perhaps the background check in and of itself, but it's the relationship of the law that, where in New York, for example, they talk about extreme risk protection orders when a person may be dangerous to themselves or others, and how you create system of checks and balances that work together to try and identify individuals who can be a risk. This is a system that we have many, many very intelligent people working in government. They just need to get together. They're smart. They're educated. How can they all come together, take the politicalization away from it, and sit down and figure out how do we get our systems to work together to be safer? We see it in all different types of industries. We're seeing a lot of it in the opioid industry, for example, where trials are going on right now relative to how problems were created with opioid use, and how now we are finally making strides and steps to make the system better by holding people accountable. So we have to work out a system in which people are going to, or systems are going to work in tandem with each other so that you can help identify the problems, just like we're doing and we see in many other industries.
According to reports, two other guns were found with the shooter. In his lengthy document, he wrote that he bought a Mossberg 500 from Pennsylvania Guns and Ammo a short drive from his house in November. He would have been 17 at the time. That gun was used by the U.S. military in the Gulf War in 91 and later in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a couple weeks after buying that gun, he received what's called a Savage Axis XP as a Christmas gift from his father so he could go hunting. According to reports, it's an inexpensive rifle sold in various retail sporting goods stores. I mean, Professor Litton, just talking about where we are right now, the country is awash in guns. This young person got a gun from his father and then bought two other guns on his own.
Well, you know, in the United States, we have a long tradition of private firearms ownership, and the private firearms ownership tradition that we have has basically split the country such that we are currently experiencing the gridlock that you've spoken about in Washington. You know, a large chunk of the country believes that firearms are an important part of civil liberties, and that the reason, you know, why we don't suffer the kinds of government repression that they see on the news in other countries like in the Middle East or in Russia or in Latin America is that we have a highly armed civilian population. And the other half of the country actually thinks that we're washing guns and that this is extremely dangerous, and that the relationship between private firearms ownership and easy access to firearms, as you mentioned, and these sorts of racial ideologies and white supremacy is a toxic mix that is likely to continue to produce these sorts of mass shootings. And this essentially creates gridlock in Washington. Any kind of legislation that smacks of gun control or regulation, either of marketing restrictions or design modifications, is pretty much dead on arrival in Washington, because nationally the country is very much split over this. As you mentioned, states are not as split over this. And so what you find is that in the wake of these mass shootings, fairly predictable reactions in states where the majority of voters support stronger gun controls. We see increasing restrictions on marketing, tighter restrictions on background checks, red flag laws. We see design modification laws like restrictions on the purchase of high capacity magazines or certain types of platforms for weapons. And in other states, like the state I live in, Georgia, we see in response to these sorts of mass shootings, liberalization of when and where you can carry a firearm. So in the wake of the nightclub shooting in Miami, for example, a few years ago, Georgia passed legislation making it easier to carry a concealed weapon on a public university campus, which before that had been illegal. And so we see people essentially in the wake of these shootings sort of doubling down on their priors. And as a result, we're likely to see continued gridlock in Washington and continued reactions that are sort of predictable at the state level.
Given what's going on in Washington, I'm just reading from Vox, a piece last March. The House passed a bill that would mandate universal background checks by a vote of 227 to 203, eight Republicans joining all but one Democrat to send the bill to the Senate. It's not going anywhere. The same bill was passed in 2019, but Mitch McConnell refused to bring the bill to the Senate for a vote. Given that not all Republicans, but most Republicans will not move on this in D.C., Kenneth, what other options are there if we cannot get federal legislation? Do we just have to deal with a patchwork of state laws?
We have to do whatever we can at this point. And if it is a state-by-state basis, then that's what we will have to do. Because ultimately, it's all about trying to keep us safe and preventing tragedies like this from occurring. And if the start of that becomes a state-by-state mission, then we will need to do that. Certain states have looked at and raised the minimum age to buy certain guns, and some states are starting to do that. And if it's going to be left to the states, then we'll just have to do the best that we can within each state, again, with the common goal of wanting to keep people safe, because I think everybody can uniformly agree the safety of individuals is important to everybody. And if we can't solve it on a federal level, then we need to figure out a way to address it on a state-by-state level.
Rose, I think there's something also that's worth mentioning here, especially given the nature of Mr. Barno's work, which is that in the United States, we don't just regulate health and safety via legislation at the federal and state level. We also regulate safety through the use of private lawsuits.
Right.
And the kind of lawsuits that are being brought by attorneys like Mr. Barno are lawsuits that are designed to put pressure on institutions, whether that's firearms manufacturers or schools or local police or the federal government, to exercise reasonable care in the implementation of the controls we already have in place. There are some suggestions that the red flag law that already exists in New York should have been able to do a better job to protect the victims in Buffalo. And one way to deal with that is not to pass more laws, as we've mentioned. You know, the political calculus is extremely difficult. It's actually to bring private lawsuits to hold people's feet to the fire to do a better job next time and to get compensation for current victims. The federal immunity bill that you mentioned at the introduction, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, makes it pretty difficult to sue a firearms manufacturer and hold them responsible for these sorts of shootings, irregardless of how careless they may have been. But that does not block individuals from bringing these sorts of lawsuits increasingly against venues like the MGM Hotel in the Las Vegas shooting, or the school in the Marjorie Stone Douglas shooting, or in this case, the possibility of perhaps litigation against state authorities or the federal government for really not doing a reasonable job of using the instruments that were available to prevent this sort of thing. So I wouldn't want to shortchange the option of private lawsuits as a way to deal with some of this. You don't need a legislative majority for private lawsuits. You just need a plaintiff's attorney, you need a client, and you need a recognizable right that a court will value and legitimate when you bring that lawsuit. And that sends a message out to do a better job next time.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the Sandy Hook $73 million settlement with Remington after a break. But since you brought up this law, this is really important. In 2005, George W. Bush signed this legislation that makes it harder to sue gun makers. He praised it as a necessary safeguard to, quote, stem frivolous lawsuits. And I was really struck, Professor Litton, by this comment from Mike Pfeiffer, the CEO of the U.S. gunmaker Sturm Ruger, at an NRA convention in 2011. He said the law is, quote, probably the only reason we have a U.S. firearms industry anymore. I mean, what goes through your mind when you hear that?
Yeah, I think that's just patently untrue. I think that's a gross exaggeration. We have liberal laws that allow individuals to sue pharmaceutical companies when they overpromote opioids. And we have seen that the pharmaceutical industry is currently paying for a lot of the social wreckage that they have wreaked by selling, for example, you know, 500,000 opioid pills or distributing 500,000 opioid pills to small towns in West Virginia with 5,000 residents. That kind of overpromotion, irresponsible marketing of opioids created an enormous national crisis. Lawsuits have started to make the industry accountable, and we're not going to destroy the pharma industry. We're going to reform the pharma industry. It's private litigation that makes that possible. And I don't think it's the case that the liability of irresponsible gun manufacturers is going to sink the industry. What it's going to do is clean up the industry. The idea here is that just like the car industry or the pharma industry, when there are bad actors or there's a lack of reasonable care in the design decisions or the marketing decisions of firearms manufacturers, they should be held responsible. If firearms manufacturers are basically exercising reasonable care, which may not be able to prevent all these sorts of incidents, but may prevent some of them, then they have nothing to worry about from lawsuits. The lawsuits are not a threat to anybody who's doing, you know, exercising reasonable care in the conduct of their business and the way they design and distribute their weapons. So I just don't buy the story. We haven't seen this in pharma. We haven't seen this in asbestos. We haven't seen this in any other industry, the medical industry that's subject to liability, that somehow liability takes the industry down. Liability essentially cleans the industry up.
Kenneth, again, you are a trial lawyer representing the family of Ruth Whitfield, who was shot and killed in Buffalo. And according to the Democrat and Chronicle, the family is considering lawsuits against those who put a semi-automatic weapon and high-capacity magazine into the hands of the accused 18-year-old shooter. Do you have any updates on that?
Well, first, the Democrat and Chronicle is accurate. And as Timothy pointed out as well, this is not about frivolity. That word gets thrown around a lot by companies that are not doing what they should be doing in large part. And again, the litigation is used to make the industry better. and as it relates to the manufacturer of this gun and how they market it, similar to opioids, how they market opioids, similarly how the gun manufacturers are marketing the guns and how the law interplays with that and how a jury could ultimately decide whether how that gun manufacturer conducted itself, whether that was reasonable, whether that was the way the gun manufacturer should have acted under the circumstances. This, and laws have been tested in New York. The Williams versus B. Miller case, for example, is a case where an Ohio-based gun manufacturer was sued and raised certain deficiencies and immunities. And Williams versus B. Miller is a case that helps define, at least in part, how to approach this litigation on behalf of the Whitfield family, on behalf of other families that were subject to this tragedy.
Before we go to break, we have an email from Holly who says, given that there is no chance of a law to limit gun use, would there be benefit to bringing to the Senate floor a simple resolution decrying the use of guns in our country? Republicans would have to either vote for it or state publicly that there isn't a problem. Today, we are talking about the epidemic of gun violence in this country and what to do about it, given that the majority of Republicans in D.C. will not budge on this issue. Today, we're joined by Timothy Litton, Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. Professor Litton is author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Kenneth Abarno is a trial lawyer who's been practicing law for almost 30 years. He's representing the family of Ruth Whitfield, an 86-year-old wife, mom, and grandma who was shot and killed by a self-described white supremacist on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about why top U.S. conservatives are having this week's Conservative Political Action Coalition, or CPAC, conference in Budapest. The keynote speaker will be Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who this week embraced the racist Great Replacement ideology. What does this say about the direction the hard right is headed in this country? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about today's topic, we're talking about what we need to do about guns in this country, given that we are seeing no movement by the majority of Republicans in Washington, D.C. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Timothy Litton is Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Kenneth Abarno is a trial lawyer who's been practicing for 30 years. He represents the family of Ruth Whitfield, an 86-year-old who was shot and killed on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. Kenneth, just thinking about the Whitfield family and all of the other families, how can these families seek justice? I mean, it's just horrific to say it has to come after. The only option is after these people are killed, they can file a lawsuit at this point. I mean, it just feels so awkward to even say, what does justice look like to these families?
And that's a great question. And when we were with the Whitfield family during one of the talks, they were with the mayor, and Mr. Whitfield was asked a question about how do you fill that void left by your mom? And his answer was elegant. The answer was, nothing will ever truly fill that void, but the family will have to grow more to help heal that wound, but not truly fill that void. Mm-hmm. Justice is a term that we try and figure out, what does that truly mean? Justice is not just the transfer of perhaps money if there is a successful resolution. It is an effort to try and prevent things like this happening in the future. And what we talk about at times is, you have the ruin, and you have the ruin of the family, and how can you create some sort of brightness out of that darkness, some legacy to grow out of the horror. And hopefully, when all is said and done with this, the legacy of the Whitfield family will be that their courage in going forward to try and prevent a catastrophe like this from happening again, that it was only able to go forward because of the devastation that occurred. Sounds a little awkward, but we have to figure out a way to try and make something good out of something so bad. Justice, then, it becomes, how do we get better? How do we make the world a safer place because of this? Because we can't turn back time. We can only look forward and say, how can we hopefully never have to sit with another family like the Whitfield family and say, how can we help the next family? We don't want to have to do that.
Professor Litton, I think that's what makes this issue just so difficult and infuriating, to think that after Sandy Hook, a massacre of 20 first graders and six adults on December 14th, 2012, and nothing changed. I mean, that's when we did so many shows about that. And we thought, if this country does not move, we're lost. And, you know, speaking about the elegant response from Ruth Whitfield's son, the New York Times wrote about that Sandy Hook settlement, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Francine Wheeler, whose six-year-old was killed, said, quote, David, her husband, and I will never have true justice. True justice would be our 15-year-old healthy and standing next to us right now. But Benny will never be 15. He will be six forever because he's gone forever. And Professor Litton, what makes this so frustrating is after every horrific shooting, we say never again, and it happens again and again.
You know, the firearms industry and firearms policy is really kind of sui generis in the United States. There's no other policy area that I know that's anything like it. When you have a giant disaster, any sort of major catastrophe, let's say it's a hurricane or an earthquake, there's a huge shakeup that happens in housing policy and in zoning policy to make sure that houses and buildings are better supported. And there are sort of policy reforms that grow out of that. If you have a nationwide foodborne illness outbreak associated with ground beef or leafy greens, there's usually some sort of shakeup or reform that happens where we change directions and we try some new policy to make food safety work a little bit better. And when there are a series of crashes associated with a car or some, you know, horrific set of traffic accidents, we change consumer safety policy with regard to automobiles. The only area that I know of where horrific tragedies occur and people just get people just double down in where they already are. There's no sort of shakeup or reevaluation is when it comes to firearms. When we have these tragedies, no matter how terrible they are, you mentioned Sandy Hook, and they, you know, one is as terrible as the next. People essentially double down in where they already are. People who are, you know, in favor of greater restrictions on firearms ownership become more fervent about that cause. And people who believe in the liberty to own private, you know, ownership of firearms double down in their belief about where does they when and where they should be able to carry firearms to protect themselves. And so I don't think any other area of American policy works this way. And I'm not sure why, but there's just nothing that seems to shake people's convictions about this.
I'm glad you brought this up, because unless you are in this world, you probably don't know much about this industry. I mean, how many of us can name five gun makers or even a couple? And The Hill had a piece about how the gun industry is bragging about how many jobs they're creating because their industry is booming. The National Shooting Sports Foundation reports in its latest annual update on the status of the industry that it generated more than $70 billion, $70 billion in the past year, compared to $19 billion in 2008. And just one more statistic, 7.5 million Americans bought firearms for the first time between January 2019 and April 2021. And according to the data, Professor Litton, when these shootings happen, the stocks go up and the gun sales go up. What else do we need to know about this powerful industry?
Well, I would keep in mind that, you know, the gun industry is a significant industry, but it's not an industry on the sort of scale of the healthcare industry or the pharma industry. It's an industry that, you know, two decades ago, many firearms manufacturers worked on a relatively small margin. And even today, you know, firearms manufacturers faced with liability are in some ways more economically fragile than what we talk about with big pharma. You talk about $70 billion in an annual sales for an entire industry. Well, pharma companies are paying that out in settlements in the opioid litigation. So one thing to keep in mind is that it's a smaller or moderate size industry. The thing that you mentioned that's interesting about this industry is that it has been marketing extremely hard to convince people to buy a product that is so well made it never wears out. When you buy a blender after a few years or a washing machine, it wears out and the company comes back and they can sell you another. When you buy a handgun or a rifle, that's a precision instrument that probably will never wear out if it's properly made. And so the firearms industry needs to figure out a business model where they can sell you another gun, even though you already have one, or find people who don't yet own one and sell them one. And so what they've done is that they've marketed the idea of self-protection and the danger from crime very hard in the last decade and a half. And they've convinced people that firearms are no longer a matter of sort of hunting rights. If you look at an NRA magazine from 25 years ago, it's filled with hunters. If you look at an NRA magazine now, or you look at the marketing materials, it's filled with people protecting their homes with AR-15 platform weapons from supposed hordes of people who are going to be busting in through the windows. I've talked to security guards in downtown Atlanta who own AR-15 platform weapons, and I asked them, why would you need a weapon with that much firepower? And they said, I'm worried about, you know, people invading my house. And they go to the range and they don't just shoot, they run drills. So there's this idea that you not only need a firearm if you don't own one already, you need several firearms and you need a more powerful one because the world is increasingly dangerous. And that sort of rhetoric doesn't really match what's going on. Sometimes crime rates are up and sometimes they're down, but gun sales seem to be up all of the time. The other thing to keep in mind is what you mentioned, which is that people who own firearms, especially firearms rights enthusiasts, feel very threatened by any sort of possibility of increasing restrictions. And so in the wake of mass shootings, there's a worry that there'll be a backlash and some sort of gun control. And so if there's a mass shooting, there tend to be increases in firearm sales. The only time at which that was not true was during the Trump administration, where people felt pretty assured that even after a mass shooting, there wouldn't be any kind of legislative backlash. But we're starting to see this again with the Biden administration. And so when there are mass shootings, people go out and buy more guns. The last thing I would mention is that during the pandemic, we saw dramatic rises in firearm sales, especially to first-time buyers. And I think there was a lot of anxiety in different parts of the population among people who didn't already own firearms. Anxieties about the withdrawal of police protection, anxieties about civil unrest on the street. And to some people, anxieties about big government and lockdowns. People from different parts of this political spectrum got nervous and went out and purchased their first firearm. And we saw huge increases in the volume of firearm sales over the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, and to that point, in this Hill article, half of new gun owners in that time period between January 2019 and April 2021 were women. 40% were Black or Latino.
People were very worried about unrest on the street, and they were worried that there was not adequate police protection. And as a result, you know, there was a firearms industry very willing to sell them weapons to protect themselves and their homes. And people felt frightened enough to do it. And I think the pandemic itself just ramped up the level of anxiety about a whole host of issues. And so the combination of, you know, civil unrest over, you know, police misconduct and the marketing and the pandemic, I think was, you know, the perfect recipe for increasing firearm sales.
Georgia State University College of Law professor Timothy Litton is author of Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Kenneth Abarno is a trial lawyer who's been practicing law for almost 30 years. He's representing the family of Ruth Whitfield, an 86-year-old who was shot and killed on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. Let's take a few calls and then we'll spend a little bit more time talking about the Sandy Hook settlement. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Thanks for holding.
Hear me.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, good. I just had to take off an N95 mask. Talk about product safety. And why can an 18-year-old buy a gun if a person has to be 21 years old to buy marijuana? And you're absolutely relevant to bring in the pharmaceutical industry, opioids, which kill 100,000 people a year, and the asbestos industry. As somebody who was injured in a workplace injury and became disabled, I'm sort of a fanatic about product safety, label reading. And why can somebody get a gun that is absolutely unsafe? And I buy marijuana And I get a beautiful label with the cannabinoids, the CBDs, the THCs, the lab that did the product testing. Why is this a felony? And guns are absolutely requisite.
Well, great question. Kenneth, why can an 18-year-old buy a gun, a semi-automatic?
There are certain laws that have been enacted. And one is under the Gun Control Act that there is a minimum age of 18 years or older for certain firearms. And that is a law that we have. It's a federal law. Now, states can, on a state-by-state basis, revisit that. But there's been a reluctance for states to do that on a consistent basis throughout the United States. So the federal law is enacted to allow that. Mm.
Well, thank you for the call, Mary. Let's go next to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
Wow. I so enjoy your show. I listen faithfully.
Thanks.
I support so totally the guests, the statements of the guests and their perspective, their plans. My contribution here is it's kind of a left turn. My thought is that we really need to double down on getting people, citizens, to vote. Something like only 30% of the people, of the voters, potential voters in this country, actually go to the trouble of expressing their will. And, you know, if people don't vote, I mean, let's say this. Mention has been made of how much the public understands this and would like to see it change. Well, the only way it's going to change if people change the politicians in power. You know, I speak of people like Mitch McConnell, who stands in the way of so many progressive forms of legislation. Anyway, I can mention Citizens United in passing, but here's my last suggestion. I would like to see voters be penalized for not voting. They do it in Australia, and they get turnouts, you know, 80, 90%. So that's my comment. Thank you.
You know, thank you, GS. I've been wanting to do a show about this because we had an assembly race in San Francisco just recently. San Francisco, we only had a 29% turnout. And then even though we had record turnout during the Biden-Trump election, 80 million people still did not vote. 80 million. So your point is taken. And we just had an election yesterday, and we're going to talk about the results on Friday. Thank you for your comment, and thank you for listening. We have an email from Sally, who says, what is stopping lawsuits to be brought against the Congress and Senate and the Republican Party if they continue to block gun safety laws? What are your thoughts about that, Kenneth?
Unfortunately, attempting to bring litigation against the government is not deemed to be the true path to take on this from a viability standpoint in particular, and being able to sue the government under those circumstances. The path is best toward trying to hold the manufacturers and the distributors responsible. And that is the path toward a more responsible environment that will gain more of a consensus. And, you know, from a law standpoint, I believe the caller was GS. GS brought up a great point about getting out the vote. And we've heard a lot about getting out the vote. And we hear from clients a lot, whether it's in these types of cases or in cases where there's damage caps that have been enacted because of tort reform. And clients don't understand that they have limits on their damages a lot of times. And then when we explain to them how that comes to pass, it comes to pass because certain people are elected. Once they are elected, they have certain views, and those views get enacted and become laws that ultimately go to harm the people who are injured or prevent them from moving forward. There's ways around those to certain extents, but ultimately what we have to do is try and, as Timothy pointed out earlier, look to the manufacturers to be more responsible in what they do and develop and articulate the standard of care that we should have for each of those manufacturers. And that'll be on a state-by-state, often by a county-by-county basis, jury-by-jury basis. And that's how you will hopefully be able to at least enact change along the way to help us live in a safer environment.
In the case of the Sandy Hook lawsuit, I mean, what a harrowing experience this must have been for the loved ones. According to the New York Times, this lawsuit was filed in Connecticut State Court in 2014, and it meandered its way through the court system for years without making much progress. And then an appeal brought by the families elevated the case to the state Supreme Court. So this took, what, almost 8 years? You can't even imagine. Can we talk about this? Because I think it's really important. So just a few details. In February, the nine families of the Sandy Hook school shooting victims settled a lawsuit for $73 million against Remington. This is the maker of the AR-15 style rifle used in the massacre that killed 20 first graders and six adults in 2012. The lawsuit argued that Remington promoted sales of the weapon to troubled men like the killer. In addition to the financial settlement, Remington agreed to release thousands of pages of internal company documents, including possible plans for how to market the weapon used in the massacre. So, Professor Litton, what is your response to this and the angle the families took in this lawsuit?
Well, it's very unclear what to say about the implications of the Sandy Hook settlement. I think on the one hand, it was a historic settlement from the point of view of the families, that they were able to get some sort of vindication after, as you mentioned, a number of years pursuing this litigation. But the settlement left unsettled the question that was really at the heart of that case, which is whether or not these sorts of theories are enough to qualify for one of the exceptions to federal immunity. As I mentioned a little earlier, in 2005, during the Bush administration, Congress passed an immunity bill called the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And the purpose of that act was to shield firearm sellers, both manufacturers and retailers, for any kind of liability growing out of an injury that was the result of a misuse, a criminal misuse of a weapon. So that if Remington sold a weapon and it was criminally misused by someone, that regardless of Remington's sales or marketing practices, Remington could not be held liable for that. One of the exceptions to this immunity, and the immunity bill did really stop these lawsuits for a long time. One of the exceptions to the immunity is if the sale was made in violation of a state or federal law applicable to the sale of a firearm. And the state or federal law that was alleged to have been violated in the Sandy Hook case was the Connecticut Fair Trade Practices Act, which is not specific to firearms, but it does, of course, cover firearms like all other types of consumer products. And so the Sandy Hook families argued that by selling this weapon in a way that generated, marketing among people who were likely to misuse it, this was an unreasonable practice. It was an immoral type of selling practice, and that under Connecticut law qualifies as an unfair trade practice. The Connecticut Supreme Court accepted this theory and said that violation of the general consumer protection law does qualify for an exception under PLCA. But that same theory actually was rejected by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California. And so the real answer to that question is going to lie with the Supreme Court of the United States. So that whether or not you could replicate this kind of lawsuit elsewhere really is not clear yet. And we're going to have to wait for a case to find its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Wow. The Sandy Hook case did not find its way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rejected the opportunity to review the Connecticut Supreme Court's answer to this question because I think they wanted things to play out in the trial court. And of course, they never did because the case settled.
Do you have anything to add about the Sandy Hook settlement and its significance, Ken?
Not other than what Timothy talked about. He covered it, and obviously we'll look into the rulings and the pleadings and how and if those documents become available, how those might allow for a path for potential responsibility in this case.
And also, talking about regulating the gun industry, last month the New York Times reported that gun control advocates are petitioning the Federal Trade Commission to investigate and regulate the firearms industry as it has with tobacco, saying that gun manufacturers are using deceptive advertising practices. Given that we cannot get legislation at the federal level, Ken, what would this do?
Again, we would ultimately be facing those questions in courts, as Timothy pointed out, and to see if a court will adopt a theory that there are unfair trade practices acts going on with respect to the marketing of the product. You have a gun here that some of the marketing in the past has it quoted, consider your man card reissued. What's that mean? How are you marketing that? And is that potentially a violation of a consumer law? And that's going to be for a court to put its eyes on. That will be before a court, presumably, at some point in time in the not-too-distant future as it relates to the mass shooting in Buffalo.
Well, we have a really important decision coming down sometime next month. We're expecting a Supreme Court ruling that will determine what guns are legally allowed to be carried in New York. Professor Litton, this is going to be a very important decision.
Yes, you know, one of your callers mentioned that we could deal with this problem effectively by getting more people to vote. And I think it's important to point out that, in fact, the question that you're raising now has nothing to do with what people want to see in public policy in terms of their vote. It has to do with what the Supreme Court thinks are the Second Amendment rights that individuals have. So if the Supreme Court finds that individuals have a constitutional right to carry certain types of weapons in New York State, it doesn't matter what the majority of New Yorkers think, and it doesn't matter what the New York legislature does. The whole purpose of constitutional rights is really to give an individual the ability to resist what the majority might want to impose on them. What's interesting about this case in particular is we've just seen the Supreme Court suggest that the constitutional right to abortion doesn't really, or we've seen a leak of an opinion that suggests that the court is about to suggest that individuals don't have a constitutional right to abortion. That's something that should be decided at the ballot box by voters. They're actually doing the reverse when it comes to guns. What they're saying is that we don't really want this to be a matter of what voters want at the ballot box. We want to enshrine this in the Constitution so that individuals have the right to own and possess, you know, AR-15 platform weapons and to carry them in New York if they wish, regardless of what the majority of voters want.
Wow, that is such an important point, and we would love to have both of you back next month when that decision comes down. Timothy Litton is Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development and Professor of Law at Georgia State University College of Law and author of Suing the Gun Industry. Kenneth Abarno is a trial lawyer who is representing the family of Ruth Whitfield, an 86-year-old who was shot and killed on Saturday in Buffalo, New York. Professor Litton and Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.